The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community.
With convenient locations throughout northern New England.
World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more.
Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Judging from discussions in online parenting forums, policies which prevent teachers from hugging or placing hands on a student either enforce good boundaries or are signs that the nanny state has taken over. Not as often discussed is hitting or spanking kids at school, though corporal punishment is allowed in public schools in 19 states. Momentum to abolish corporal punishment in schools started in the 1970s and then stalled. Now, its use is heavily concentrated in southern states. A new report from the Society for Research in Child Development found higher child mortality and poverty rates, less education spending per student, and lower graduation rates in districts where corporal punishment is permitted. The research also found racial and gender discrimination in applying punishment. The findings are again sparking a debate over whether it is time to finally retire the practice. Elizabeth Gershoff is a developmental psychologist and faculty research associate at the University of Texas, Austin. She's co-author of the report on corporal punishment in U.S. schools. Also with us is co-author Sarah Font, assistant professor of sociology at Penn State. Elizabeth and Sarah, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you.
So as it stands, 19 states do allow corporal punishment in public schools. Did you find data on how often it is used or if it's more or less active in some states than others?
We did have data from the U.S. Department of Education, which collects information from all public schools in the country, which is all 90,000 public schools, about the kinds of discipline they use and some characteristics of the children who they discipline. And so we focused on the 19 states where corporal punishment is still legal in schools and found that there was some variation across the states in how often they use it. Some states almost never use it, Colorado, Arizona, Idaho. But then some states are using it quite a bit. So Arkansas, Alabama, and Mississippi. In each of those states, more than half of the schools are reporting using some corporal punishment at some point in the school year.
I'm thinking about those three, Mississippi, Alabama, Arkansas, leading in the number of kids who receive corporal punishment. But it also is spread out against other states that you mentioned. So this is not something we can say, oh, this is a regional problem, only going on in some places.
It is still going on in all of the 19 states where it is legal. And most of those states are in the southeastern part of the United States. But others, like there's Indiana, Idaho, Wyoming, which are not considered part of the South, where it is still happening. And so in most of these states, we're seeing it start to fade. So in North Carolina, for example, there's only a handful of districts where it's still even legal. Most of the school boards have actually banned it themselves. But other states like Mississippi and Alabama, it's being used still pretty widespread across the state.
Any ideas why it is changing or ceasing in some states like North Carolina, as you mentioned?
So some states, I believe North Carolina, Liz, correct me if I'm wrong, but has an opt-in policy where parents have to now give permission for their children to be subject to corporal punishment, which I assume has contributed to a decline.
And in your reporting from these states, is corporal punishment defined as, you know, just a teacher using a hand, paddle, any other, I mean, ruler, weapon?
Well, the data that we have don't specify exactly how it was administered, but I have looked through various state and local guides on discipline, and school districts will say very clearly that they allow certain implements like paddles, and a common paddle size is a wooden board that is 2 feet long, 4 inches wide, and a half inch thick, and that is a fairly common size paddle. But in some cases, I think teachers or principals are using open hands as well, which is more like a spanking a parent would do. But I think a majority of schools actually use a paddle, a ruler, or some other object.
Is there any evidence to show that corporal punishment is an effective way to discipline children?
Actually, all of the evidence points to the opposite. It points to corporal punishment being ineffective at teaching children how to behave. There is a wealth of research on the effects of corporal punishment by parents, which we often think of as spanking. And it overwhelmingly shows there's negative outcomes for children linked to a spanking. The very few studies that have been done on corporal punishment in schools similarly find that the more children are corporally punished or paddled in school, the worse they do in school and the more behavior problems they have.
Districts where physical punishment is still allowed have a host of other problems: higher poverty rates and mortality rates among children, lower graduation rates, more crowded schools, less education spending. Is there any known correlation between corporal punishment and those kind of issues, or are these just representative of other dynamics and trends in the schools?
There are definitely local conditions that predict the probability of a school using corporal punishment or not. Schools that, for example, receive Title I funding, which has to do with the percent of students in poverty, are much more likely to use corporal punishment than other schools. But I think to a large extent that's explained by cultural characteristics of the areas, even aside from poverty. In the South, obviously, those states have higher poverty rates to begin with. But areas with higher presence of evangelicals, more conservative areas, and areas with more racial minorities tend to be more likely to use corporal punishment than other areas, net of poverty rates.
There's another layer here. Not only are most of the states which allow corporal punishment in the South, but you also did find, as you mentioned about minority kids, that more Black students bear the brunt of physical punishment.
Yeah, that's one of the more upsetting aspects of our findings, is that pretty consistently, if corporal punishment is being used in a district, it is being used disproportionately against children who are Black, as well as boys and children with disabilities. And that is a definitely a disturbing aspect of corporal punishment. And then we should say, though, that that's consistent with disparities that have been found in other aspects of discipline, so suspensions and expulsions, also see these kind of disparities. But I think it's upsetting for most Americans to think of children being, some groups of children being singled out for being hit in schools over other children, particularly children with disabilities. I mean, I think most Americans would think that's pretty abhorrent, that that these children are being hit for discipline when they may not be able to control what they're doing because of their disabilities.
I'm speaking with Elizabeth Gershoff and Sarah Font. They're co-authors of a recent study examining the continued use of corporal punishment in American public schools. Any data on the racial or gender profile of teachers who are more likely to use corporal punishment?
That's an interesting question. The U.S. Department of Education data does not have information on the teachers or principals who administer the corporal punishment, so we actually don't know about that.
We did see in some other analyses that when schools and counties that have as the percentage of Black parents in the county increases, the likelihood of using corporal punishment increases, but only until Blacks are the majority of the area. At that point, it declines, which would suggest that the extent to which the practice is used in a discriminatory way declines when minority groups constitute a majority of the area, which may also mean then that they have a higher representation in the school as teachers and administrators.
There are some other disparities. Boys are more likely to receive corporal punishment than girls are. Some districts where students with disabilities, as you mentioned, more likely to be physically punished. Do these disparities open up larger questions about discrimination and violation of rights societally?
They definitely do. I mean, each of these disparities goes against federal law prohibiting discrimination by race, by gender, and by disability status. And the U.S. Department of Education Office for Civil Rights, which collects this data, actually also has the job of enforcing these laws in the education system. And so they are aware of these disparities, but have not done anything yet to address them. I mean, much of this happens at the state level, but the federal government could pursue some regulations or some other way of addressing the disparities and discrimination in the states.
Well, you do write in the study that in any other context, hitting another person with a weapon like a paddle, which is used frequently in these schools, would be considered assault. Why do these rules get thrown out in public schools?
Well, that's a very interesting question. Sarah, you can go ahead.
So I was going to say, although in general, right, parents do have the right to hit their children, and school administration or school personnel are given sort of parental rights while children are at school to discipline them, the states tend to take this a step further in that they exempt corporal punishment in schools from civil or criminal liability, even when it causes an injury, which a non-accidental physical injury being the general definition of child physical abuse. And so I think it's generally surprising to people that the exemption goes as far as it does.
The idea that it's still legal to hit children in schools is surprising, given that the government does not allow hitting of any other class of person. So we don't hit prisoners anymore. We don't hit people in the military. You know, it's even illegal to hit animals. But for some reason, we have exempted children from the same protections that we afford ourselves, which is a sad statement on how we treat children in this country. I think there's a double standard here, and we're not giving children the same protection from assault with weapons that we give to adults.
Well, Elizabeth and Sarah, thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you for having
you.
Elizabeth Gershoff, a developmental psychologist and faculty research associate at UT Austin, co-author of the Society for Research in Child Development's Social Policy Report on Corporal Punishment in U.S. Public Schools. Sarah Font, she is assistant professor of sociology at Penn State and co-author of the study. You'll find a link to read the study along with the Pacific Standard article that led us to it at our website, wordofmouthradio.org.
Word of mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. When James Barker took the helm in 2001, Clemson University was number 38 on the U.S. News & World Report rankings for public universities. President Barker had a resolute vision to crack the top 20. John Warner was teaching there in the mid-aughts, and he watched tuition go up, numbers of first-generation students go down, and an administration bent on hitting the right numbers as it clawed its way briefly into the magic circle. John's article, What Colleges Lose When They Chase Prestige, originally appeared in Inside Higher Ed, but it's been passed around all over. We found it on Slate. John, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks for having me.
James Barker is no longer president, but was when you came on in 2005. How was it articulated to you and the faculty and the students that they wanted to hit top 20?
Well, it was sort of the central institutional goal. So any administrative communication would remind you that our goal was to be part of the top 20 public universities as a kind of cheerleader chant or something, you know, like top 20, top 20, top 20. You know, as faculty, it didn't mean a whole lot, particularly as non-tenure track faculty, as an instructor as I was. I didn't have any power to affect these changes. I was just sort of one of the instruments that was acted upon as these goals were pursued.
But one of the numbers in these rankings, which are, as we find out, quite driven by data points, is that you have more faculty with PhDs. Was there pressure on the faculty to go out and get themselves a PhD?
Well, there was a very, I thought, odd meeting we had with the provost of all of the non-tenure track lecturing faculty who were teaching upper division classes, who were teaching classes taught by any other category of faculty, to encourage us to go get advanced degrees. I happen to have a terminal degree already, a master's in fine arts, so I would have been exempt. But it was really just a move to improve our image on paper. It wouldn't have changed the quality of instruction. In fact, it would have probably harmed it, as legions of instructors go pursue PhDs in their alleged spare time that didn't really exist. So it just seemed to me at the time ill-conceived and sort of silly. And I remember a lot of pushback from me and others in the meeting, sort of, what is the purpose of this? And the purpose was, quote-unquote, data-driven. More PhDs looks better in the U.S. News & World Report rankings, regardless of what that may reflect in terms of the quality of education.
Well, what did you notice in your classes? Changes in the student population or attitudes?
there really wasn't a ton of interference there, and for the most part, I think students not really being fully aware of the implications of some of these things were kind of enthused by the idea of being a top 20 university, the image that their degree may carry more prestige. From a practical aspect, one of the things that would happen was we would have smaller classes when the U.S. News and World Report data would be collected. So if you were under 20 students, so 19 students, you were considered a small class. So fall semesters, I'd have no more than 19 students in my writing intensive courses. But then spring, because you know we would then not be servicing as many students as we needed to in the fall, we would see the totals creep up to 22, 23, 24, particularly in a required technical writing course that I taught there at the time that needed to be taken for graduation for many majors. So there was no choice but to add them in. So fall, 19 students, spring, 24 students, all in effort to game the rankings, in my opinion, and which really sort of eroded the quality of the experience in the spring.
Well, your article has been passed around quite a bit, and I saw a number of comments, one that appeared to have been from a Clemson student who said, we had sometimes classes of 20, five of them crammed into one place with one teacher, you know, so suggesting that there is some manipulation of the data going on here, that they can say, yes, yeah, small class sizes, but in reality, they're all pushed into one place at one time.
I never experienced that personally, although I had heard tales of that. And you also would see moves where classes of 50, which was another threshold in terms of class size, could be increased to 75 or 85 or 100 without any penalty in the data. It really is a reflection of the sorts of data that the survey collects is not particularly meaningful when it comes to measuring what's happening inside an institution. It's mostly about inputs, as well as easily measured things like class size, which are not always indicators of what's actually happening.
Well, you also highlight who doesn't get to show up. A change in the student population as far as who's eligible because they want high-ranking SAT students in their classes. That helps the rankings.
Yeah, the rankings depend a lot on inputs. The reasons why Harvard and Princeton and Yale and Stanford do well is because they are the most selective institutions with the highest SATs and standardized test scores and GPAs. And so if you want to move up in the rankings, you need to draw students with higher SAT scores and class rankings. And an easy way to do that is to say, I'm not going to admit anybody who is not in the top third of their class or doesn't reach a particular standardized test threshold. And in a state like South Carolina, that disadvantages huge swaths of students who have been already disadvantaged in their high school educations thanks to a lack of resources. And so for me, the mission of a public university to educate the citizens of that state is being betrayed by saying we're going to only educate the most privileged or elite of our state, is kind of turning its back on its actual mission in chasing what is essentially an abstract goal to be a top 20 university.
But the goal, despite a number of takedowns we've seen through the years about what private colleges do in order to be in these rankings and public universities, it still is the standard. So this is pressure on universities and administrators to make these kind of numbers. How do you balance that sort of outward focus and the quality of the education within?
It is a dilemma, and I don't want to be too harsh on administrations that are acting in good faith as they see it. This is not an evil conspiracy, even though I think most assessment professionals will agree that the U.S. News survey and rankings are mostly noise, not reflective of all that much. I think to balance it, it requires a real gut check, a real assessment of the values of the institution. And the problem is in states like South Carolina and many others that we're seeing across the country, Wisconsin, Louisiana, my home state of Illinois, when the public funding dries up for public institutions, they're forced to look elsewhere. And that means chasing prestige, which can help bring in outside money and outside attention, and increasingly students from outside the state who pay increased tuition. So it is a bit of a catch-22. And one of my motives of writing the article is to open up the conversation to asking us to have a broader dialogue about what it means to have public higher education institutions in this country, and that maybe we should start supporting them as the public rather than asking them to make these impossible compromises that not only harm students but are inefficient. They're wastes of time and money.
Well, John, thank you for sharing it with us.
Thank you.
John Warner, he's a columnist for the Chicago Tribune and for Inside Higher Ed. You'll find a link to read his article, What Colleges Lose When They Chase Prestige. That's at our website, wordofmouthradio.org.
Word of mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. As a radio host, the way I sound when I'm interviewing a guest is a little different than the way I sound when speaking to my mother or to a good friend. Most people adjust their tone and inflection depending on the social situation they're in. Linguists call it code switching, a term originally used for people who would switch between languages, like Spanish or English. The term has evolved to include the tones and accents and affects that we use when talking to people who feel like others. Leela Day from Cross Currents brings us the story of finding her voice.
Growing up, I heard plenty of jokes about the way I spoke.
Listen to how you talk, like a white girl. Who do you think you is?
You sound white when you're on the phone.
But I couldn't help the way I sounded. It's a default voice, just how I speak. You see, where I grew up in Las Vegas, there were two types of black kids in school. Those who hung out only with other black kids, and those who bounced back and forth between black and non-black friends. I was in the second group. And with all that switching back and forth, my voice switched too. And it still does. Like when I'm on the phone with my sister.
Girl, you better ask somebody. Uh-uh. I do not know what you are talking about.
It's not something I'm always conscious of. Sometimes it just sort of happens.
Yeah, he came in looking all crazy, acting all crazy, talking all crazy. I was like, uh-uh, you better back off.
Now, as an adult, I have fun with it.
You all up in my Kool-Aid, you don't even know the flavor.
But as a kid, it wasn't always this way. Finding my voice was, well, just painful. At school, being told I sounded white meant only one thing. I wouldn't be eating my corn dog and tater tots at the black kids' lunch table. But that was then. Nowadays, in some schools, corn dogs and tater tots have been replaced with tofu dogs and a green salad. It got me wondering if the conversation among teens may have changed too. So I went to a place where I thought I might find some black teens who've been accused of talking white, the skate park.
Black people have told me I talk white before, like, I don't know, like, what it means to, like, talk white or talk black.
Yeah. They be saying I talk white. I get pissed off. They only do it because my mom's white, you know, so I have to speak respectable. And they think since I'm black, I have to act ghetto and be stupid.
I guess talking white would be, like, I don't know. Like, I want to say, like, speaking proper, I guess. Like how most white people talk or most normal people talk, you know?
This conversation got me interested in talking to someone whose job depends on his voice.
I'm Joshua Johnson. I'm the morning newscaster for KQED Public Radio.
Johnson's been in radio for years. He's African American, and he sounds pretty similar when he's on the air.
It's Morning Edition on KQED. I'm Joshua Johnson.
And when he's talking with me in person.
Is this your radio voice?
This is my voice.
This is your voice. So is your
people ask me that a lot. They're like, do your radio voice. I'm like, have we not been talking for 15 minutes? This is it. You know, my goal on the radio is to sound like me. I don't want to
sound like the news anchor who is enunciating the headlines at you.
But Johnson says he has experienced surprise reactions when people realize he's black.
We did a show about race and diversity in Silicon Valley. And somewhere in the show I mentioned that I'm African American. I forget what the context was, but somewhere in the show I mentioned it. And I got an email from a listener who basically wrote, I never would have guessed that you were black.
Johnson says he doesn't let these reactions about his race really bother him. Like me, he's heard it all. The patronizing tone. You're so articulate. You speak so well. But Johnson thinks this ignorance can also be a lesson in disguise, to show us assumptions we often make about race.
Did you respond to that?
I did. I told him it was a very good thing that you as a white person have to stop looking at me as a black person as other and presume that I sound like everybody on BET.
I asked Johnson if he'd ever been accused of sounding white when he was growing up. He tells me that he not only heard the accusation, but he grew up with black adults insinuating that it was preferable. To sound white was to sound high quality.
In my hometown of West Palm Beach, Florida, I remember the choir director, Ms. Richardson, said, I want you to sound so good that if I put you on stage behind a curtain and had you sing to the audience, everyone would swear you were white.
To sound professionally marketable or quote-unquote proper, it's the goal most parents and teachers set out for kids. I mean, saying the word ain't in my house would warrant a side glare from mom that was just as bad as a spanking. Johnson says he was very aware of this as a child.
I always knew there was something blessed and something cursed about the way I spoke. I knew that it would open doors for me, and I knew that none of my friends was behind those doors.
But what is it about the fear of those doors closing because of the way we sound? There's actually a name for it. It's called linguistic profiling, a term coined by Professor John Baugh, a PhD at Stanford University. He did a study where he selected 5 racially diverse cities in the Bay Area to inquire about housing for rent. First, he called using an African-American accent.
Yes, my name is Michael Davis. I was calling to see if you might have any houses for rent that might be available.
Then he called again, this time with a Latino accent.
Hello, this is Juan Ramirez. I'm calling about the apartment you have advertised in the paper.
With these accents, Ball was told nothing was available. But when he switched to what he called a neutral accent, he was often invited to see the properties. I was linguistically profiled recently. I was working on a story that involved a support group for African Americans. Many of them had a criminal record. At first, they seemed very open to being interviewed, but then they turned cold. Days turned into weeks of messages without a return phone call. When we finally met, one of the coordinators laughed. I would have gotten back to you sooner if I would have known you were black. And although we both laughed together about her comment, I had a moment of deflation, like eating that corn dog alone at lunch. But as for my voice, whether it works to my advantage or not, it's just the one I got. For Cross Currents, I'm Leela Day.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. What you say reveals a lot about your character. How you say it reveals a lot about where you call home. If you come from the Northeast, you probably call your rubber-soled workout shoes sneakers, whereas pretty much the rest of the country says tennis shoes. Then there's the grinder hoagie sub-distinction and that soda pop versus tonic controversy, which many Southerners ignore by calling any carbonated beverage Coke. Josh Katz is graphics editor at the New York Times, where he posted an interactive dialect quiz that could pretty well determine where you're from through just a few questions. Now he's turned that quiz into a book called Speaking American, How Y'all Use and You Guys Talk.
So the original idea for the book started from what's called the Harvard Dialect Survey, which sort of inspired me to go out and collect my own data, which forms the backbone of the book.
How is dialect different from a regional accent? I mean, can they be used interchangeably?
Dialect encompasses not only your accent, but also the choice of words that you use. So whether you say, for example, soda, pop, Coke, or tonic, that's comes within dialect, but not accent.
So in the quiz, there are 25 words. Are there just a couple of words that you could hear me or someone else say and you'd think, ah, I know where they're from?
It really varies by region. There are some things. So if someone calls the night before Halloween Mischief Night or Devil's Night, Mischief Night is very much a New Jersey, Philadelphia kind of word. Devil's Night is very much a Pittsburgh or Michigan kind of thing. So that's one example. Another one is if you call a water fountain a bubbler, there's really only two places in the country that do that, Rhode Island and the area around Rhode Island, and then Wisconsin.
It's a really beautifully designed book. So what are some of the challenges in visually representing this kind of information?
Yeah, so it's really designed to be a very visually accessible book, really focused on these maps of where in the country people say different things. And I want to make it very kind of colorful and fun as an easy introduction to what can be a very fun subject.
So like pecan, we've got a darkened red just around the southern United States for the most part.
So the fun thing about that word, you talk to 10 different people and you're going to get 10 different pronunciations of pecan.
So you have pecan, 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 pecan.
Some people pronounce it differently if they're talking about pecan pie versus just the nut by itself. So it gets pretty complicated.
Well, how about that original dialect quiz that you wrote for the New York Times? How do you design a quiz like that? I mean, are you concerned at all about self-reporting biases or that someone's going to try and say that they're saying something, quote unquote, properly?
Sure. That's why in a lot of ways, the vocabulary questions can be more revealing, because a lot of people think that they're pronouncing a word a certain way, but they're actually pronouncing it an entirely different way. So you're not, and especially when you stop and think before you speak, you tend to see people's accents fade somewhat because they're very self-conscious about how they're speaking. So using a few statistical tools, I was able to try and control for some of those biases. And also I'd like to focus more on the vocabulary questions versus the pronunciation question. So an example of a vocabulary word, something like whether you call it a lightning bug or a firefly. You know, most people know why use this word or that word. Whereas pronunciation is an example like pecan or how you say aunt, like your relative, whether you say aunt or aunt.
Well, we found ourselves repeating the different pronunciations over and over until we'd pretty much confused ourselves.
That does tend to happen.
What are some of the wackiest regional terms that you found in your research?
One of the most fun ones, I thought, was what people call, what I call a sun shower, which is when it's raining and the sun is shining at the same time. Before I started this research, I assumed that everyone in the country also called that a sun shower, but not only was that not true, but actually in most of the country, people don't have a word for that at all. And in a good portion of the South, they call that the devil beating his wife.
It's a very rich image.
It is.
How about words like tonic that sound kind of old-fashioned or out of date to those of us who don't use them? My mother says tonic,
sure,
for example.
Yeah, and tonic, I think, is still said by about a quarter of the people from Boston. It's fading slightly. So a lot of these dialect markers, you know, and you'll read articles where people talk about, oh, because of modern technology, regional dialects are going to fade, they're going to go extinct, and it just really hasn't happened. And people have been predicting that, you know, ever since they came out with the radio, but these regional dialects have persisted through time.
Have you picked up any particular expressions that you're throwing around every now and again?
You know, I haven't. And I went to grad school in North Carolina, and I was really hoping that I would pick up y'all, and it just hasn't taken. And I've been pretty disappointed about that.
I'm sorry. You can there's still time.
There's still, yeah, well, now I live in New York, so I don't know. I think that ship has sailed.
Okay. Big current topical question, Nevada or Nevada?
So I've been told it's Nevada and that they take that very seriously.
Yeah, so I've heard.
And that's one of the fun things about these regional dialects is that with a lot of these different dialect markers, people really take them as part of their identity. Like I grew up in South Jersey, and for me, that sandwich will always be a hoagie. It's never a sub, it's always a hoagie, and it really becomes part of who you are and where you're from, which I think makes the book really fun.
Well, I'm sorry to differ with you, Josh, but it's a grinder.
All right. This interview is over.
Well, Josh, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thanks for having me.
Josh Katz, he's a graphics editor at the New York Times and author of Speaking American, How Y'all Use and You Guys Talk. It's a brilliant visual guide to American dialect based on research compiled by Josh. You'll find a link to learn more about the book and to take the quiz for yourself at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. No matter where you're from, if you've watched TV in the last 30 years and speak American, you know what this means.
Pardon me, would you have any Grey Poupon?
But of course.
Grey Poupon. It even has wine.
That 1981 commercial brought luxury, class, and a memorable catchphrase to the bougie mustard. A decade later, Grey Poupon found an unexpected audience. Hip-hop. Brooklyn-based DOSFX made what is likely the first Grey Poupon reference in hip-hop in 1992, and that was just the beginning. Estelle Caswell tracked just how often the condiment comes up in songs and put together an interactive article and video for Vox, showing just how much Grey Poupon has spread out in hip-hop. Estelle, welcome to Word of Mouth.
It's nice to be here. Thank you.
So how did you get onto this Grey Poupon thing?
I really enjoy Wu-Tang Clan and Ghostface Killah's Iron Man album that came out in 1996 is one of my favorites. And just in an effort to sort of keep my mind in the hip-hop mood, because I make a lot of music analysis videos, I started listening to that album and realized almost 20 minutes in that I had heard Grey Poupon referenced twice by two different rappers, Raekwon and Ghostface himself. And it just kind of interested me because I had also recently done a video on Kanye West, and he referenced it in his latest album, The Life of Pablo.
Easy, 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 this is pure lecture. I give him Grey Poupon on a DJ Mustard.
Why in the world are they talking about this mustard? Like, nobody even really talks about Grey Poupon in regular conversation. It just kind of sparked a big curiosity in me, and I immediately started tracking as many songs as I could that reference it.
So you tracked all these songs, you made these charts and graphs. How many songs did you come up with that Grey Poupon is actually mentioned in?
Right around 120. There's a lot more if you search Genius's lyric database, but I actually individually verified each song to make sure that it was a recorded album that at least is on a small label rather than like independently released and nobody's heard of it. I wanted to make sure all the songs had some cultural context. Mm-hmm. And of course, make sure that they were recorded so that they could hypothetically be played on the radio.
First of all, before we move on, this shit is like a Yukon dawn. Spread it out like Grey Poupon.
You talked to some people and you also came up with some ideas of why Grey Poupon is so pervasive in hip hop. So let's go through some of those reasons.
Sure. Well, the first recorded reference that I could find was from DOSFX in 1992, which is right at the heart of when the campaign became really prevalent in pop culture, like just people talking about it and referencing it. Almost within the same month that DOSFX released Dead Serious, Wayne's World premiered, and of course that was a huge cultural moment.
Pardon me, do you have any Grey Poupon?
I talked to Open Mike Eagle, who is a rapper that I really admire, and he said that he brings it up in freestyles a lot because it's an easy word to rhyme. And of course, I realized that once I tracked all the songs, it rhymes with futon and coupon and crouton, Louis Vuitton, Louboutin, pretty much anything you could poop on. It rhymes with so many things.
Okay, so it's a great rhyming song, but there's also a kind of status thing that gets played with here.
Absolutely. You know, when the commercial premiered, it hadn't really been in front of many people across the United States except for an upper-class audience because it was only in high-end magazines. And so the first run of the campaign during the 80s, it wasn't really tongue in cheek. It really was like people on yachts using this mustard and really perpetuating this idea of being bougie, being upper class, being the upper crust and ritzy. And this mustard was right along with that. I keep 20 in the pocket. You talking about 80 if the Bentley is the
topic. But of course, gotta fly the spot. Well, because we have a chart that you put together, we can see year by year how often it was used in songs. And there's a big surge some 25 years after that first commercial was on, 10 years after the campaign even ended. So why?
I mean, there's probably a lot of theories out there. What made the most sense to me was that in 2007, the majority of the songs that referenced Grey Poupon were actually in everyone's ears. They were chart toppers. They were on albums that did really well or were nominated or won Grammys. So they were pervasive. And from then on, it had almost created a new life in hip hop. And also the generation of rappers in 2007 are probably just growing up and were aware of the commercial in some ways, but also heard it often in the 90s when 90s hip hop was really big. So it's just a huge generation of rappers that, one, were doing really well and really mainstream. And then, of course, using Grey Poupon as a status symbol was like kind of tongue in cheek and witty. From 1991 to 97, the commercial sort of took on a new tone. I talked to one of the ad campaign veterans who worked on the commercial, and he said that they wanted it to be a bit more approachable, that they didn't want Grey Poupon to just be a condiment you used in cooking, that you wanted it to be used on your sandwich. And so they introduced a squeeze bottle that made it a little bit easier to access. And of course, they had the two really ritzy guys poking fun at each other and cracking jokes.
Pardon me, would you have any Grey Poupon?
You mean the mustard?
Yes, would you have any?
Would I? Or do I?
Both, actually.
What?
You know,
I'm asking you.
But I was asking you.
Is this about the mustard again?
Yes.
Well, now that you're talking with a public radio station about Grey Poupon, do you think it's finally played out?
I absolutely hope so. I think my biggest hope is that hip-hop artists and rappers, when they decide to put Grey Poupon in a lyric, that they realize it is a little cliche now. It's not a fun. It's not as original as it once was in 1992 when Dos Effex did it. It's so pervasive, and I think it's a great thing, but it's also like, I'd like to hear a new condiment be referenced in hip-hop.
Oh, we'll work on that, Estelle. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you so much.
Estelle Caswell, she's a senior video producer for Vox, and that's where we found her video and article about why rappers love Grey Poupon. There's a link to watch and to read it at our website, and you should definitely check out her Grey Poupon Futons and Croutons playlist that's on Spotify. The link is also at wordofmouthradio.org. And we are, of course, off to have exquisite lunches in the back seats of our respective Rolls Royces, but did want to invite you to visit at Word of Mouth on Twitter. Our chief social mediators, Logan and Molly, pulled together the team's all-time favorite GIFs and loaded them up all Tweetstorm style. It's kind of a weird Rorschach of our production/creative unit. And best of all, it's an animated palette cleanser from wall-to-wall election coverage. That's at Word of Mouth on Twitter. Thanks so much for your listening time today. Music in this episode came to us from Poddington Bear and Persona La Ave. There's a lot more to hear and explore at wordofmouthradio.org and the Word of Mouth podcast, which you can find by searching Word of Mouth NHPR in iTunes and Google Play. I'm Virginia Prescott. Until next time, this is Word of Mouth from NHPR.